You're always kind.
You're good.
Well, thank you, Bill. Boy, it's a delight to be with you this morning. I've come really prepared, so excuse me just for a moment. I want to be culturally relevant. And plus, I don't want to infect you with my viruses. No, I'm just kidding. But, this is interesting, isn't it, where we are today. And but it is great to come back. It's always good to come back and just be with friends. Last week was great. And I hope I can encourage you this morning with a multitude of different topics. I'm not going to be on one topic. I'm going to skip from topic to topic and try to tie them all together. But I did this around a theme with what I call arrows pointing to the future. You guys know from time to time you'll look in it'll be an Arkansas Democrat Gazette or a paper, and you'll see an editorialist who wants to expound on more than just one subject. And we've had that in the past, but when they do, sometimes they group their topics and subjects into short sound bites, and then with a symbol, they'll say what they feel about that topic. And it'll be an arrow that may be pointing up, or an arrow pointing down, or sideways. I was talking to David Petty. I think John Robert Starr used to use that towards the end of his career. From time to time, when you open up the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, you'll see John Brummett. He'll talk on some various topics, but ties them all together with his opinion with the arrow up or down. Have you seen that? And anytime I see those short snippets, I like it because it kind of gets me engaged, not just in one thing, but with a variety of things. And so sometimes you'll see a big issue like the presidential debates. And if it was the last presidential debate, the arrow would be down, right? I don't know if that was a debate. It was more a free-for-all. Or you'll see right after that, it'll say State of the Hogs. I'm going to let you decide where the arrow goes. Or for just levity, sometime it'll be some just random subject. Like it'll have the Westminster Dog Show. And if you saw the Westminster Dog Show this year, I guarantee you the arrow is down. I mean, Simba, the poodle, won Best in Show. And I like what one person said about Simba. It was more like a topiary shrub than a real dog. That's exactly what I felt. It was just sticks connected to big hairballs. And I went, that's not a dog. Daniel the Golden Retriever should have won. You know? Right, guys? So, that being said, we'll turn to a little more serious thing. But what I want to do is the same thing. I want to give you five arrows that I think are pointing to the future. You'll feel it. We're moving to that and the implications of those. So here's the first one. I call it the American family. The American family. And if I were analyzing the American family, the arrow for me would be down. Abraham Lincoln once said, "The strength of a nation lies in the homes of its people." And I believe that's true. I mean, we talk about everything today in our social discourse and even in the debates that are going on. Rarely does the family come up. Rarely does a husband or wife come up. It's everything else that should fix society, but we eliminate the family. But if the strength of a nation lies in the homes of its people, I think that you might agree with me that America is critically ill, with only prosperity keeping us from knowing how ill we are today. The biblical vision of the family that served American men and women for over 200 years so well, that provided a North Star for husband and wives to strive for, where young men were directed to love their wives and families and provide for them, listen, before anything else. Before anything else. And young women were directed to respect and support their husbands and nurture their families before anything else. That simple but profound biblical outline of first priorities that maybe even hear you today as you've been culturally saturated kind of sounds odd even when I read those. But that biblical outline of first priorities has now been replaced by hyper-individualism, where a couple gets together, but the prevailing drive is me, my fulfillment, but most importantly, my career. It trumps everything and everybody. And all you have to do is just drill down a little below the surface and you find that children, along with America's future, are the biggest losers. 44% of millennials now think marriage is obsolete. 80% of Americans said getting married is not necessary for living a fulfilling life. Cohabitation has exploded. For the first time in America, there are more single adults in America than married adults. The general American birth rate is half what it was in 1960, and today in American homes, there are more pets than there are children. Barely 50% of children today will grow up with both biological parents. Loneliness, depression, suicide, addiction, poverty, violence, they now swamp our schools, our government, social services, and prisons, and yet the social discourse is that those things should save us. They can never be big enough to save us from mom and dad missing. David Brooks of the New York Times just recently said it this way. The blunt fact is the traditional family, I would say one derived from the Bible, has been crumbling in slow motion for decades. And most of our social problems with education, mental health, crime, addiction, the quality of the labor force, all of it stems from that crumbling. That's why I put the arrow in the American family down. Now, I know that's discouraging. It's discouraging to me. But I just want you to know we're looking to the future. And you can't fix a problem unless you can first identify the problem, which we're refusing to do in this modern America. Without right marriage, and again, let me say, where we as a couple and our children trump my career as the first priority, where you grow up just naturally being inclined that direction because of what you've been taught and encouraged by. If that isn't taught as first priority, then here's what I want you to expect in the future. Expect America to grow even sicker and more critically ill and more profane and more violent and more completely lost. That's the future, unfortunately, without some correction. Okay, let's set that aside and jump to a second topic, totally unrelated. Bill's already touched on it, and I want to follow up on it, and that's end times. End times. Just for a second. I always love end times, don't you? And when you come to end times, I would say the arrow points up. Up. Bill mentioned that right after we went to Israel, when we were in Israel, we took a bunch of young couples to Israel a few weeks ago, and Bill had been encouraged by a friend to call Joel Rosenberg, as he mentioned. And I wasn't really sure we could get Joel because of just who he is and his popularity and his travel, but he agreed to come over to our hotel and speak to our group, which I was just thrilled with that. I mean, Joel is extremely well connected. And we found out, didn't we, Bill, how well connected when he started talking about his meeting with President Trump, his meeting with President Netanyahu, and then how he's traveled to a number of Arab Middle Eastern countries and met with Arab leaders around Christianity, including the King of Saudi Arabia and Jordan. And I mean, it was mesmerizing just listening to that. He's had 13 New York Times bestsellers. So he came over. He was a delightful, fun, funny, engaging speaker. And I hope our young couples realized how privileged they were. But I'm going to pick up on where Bill mentioned. In the midst of that talk, he did mention about something unique that has just recently taken place. And he pointed out in Ezekiel 38, if you want to write that down, that's where it's found. Ezekiel describes a gathering of nations, listen, and it mentions specifically in the end times, that will gather near Israel and be part of kind of the final apocalyptic battle. The two primary nations that are cited in Ezekiel 8 as leading this charge, he mentioned, are Gog and Ross. Gog, wouldn't that be a great name, by the way, for a grandchild? Gog. Hey, Gog, come over here. But Gog and Rosh, but they are ancient names for what now as nations, Gog being Russia and Rosh being Iran. And then Joel said this, what's interesting about this alliance, and again, I'm going to just quote Bill, never in all of human history, never, he said, has Russia and Iran cooperated together in an alliance. It's never happened. And yet Ezekiel speaks very specifically to how this alliance occurs, how it is arranged, and where it is positioned before the end times. And he was saying that 2,500 years ago, and he points specifically to these people. In fact, I'm going to read you the verse. Joel didn't cite this, but I went and looked it up, and I just read it, and here's what it says. To Ezekiel, God says, therefore prophesy Ezekiel and say to Gog, Russia, on that day when my people Israel are living in the land, Ezekiel couldn't have foreseen that a few hundred years later Israel would be taken out of the land and would disappear for 2,000 years and not be regathered until 1948. But that's amazing. There they are. But he says, when Israel is living in the land, you, Gog, or you, Russia, will come from your place out of the north, that's where Russia is, to Israel, and you, Rosh, and others, and you will come against my people, Israel. This will come about in the last days where I will bring you against my people and my land, Israel. Whoa! Does that feel, man, like up to date or what? Because just recently, I mean, just within the last few years, Iran and Russia have not only cooperated economically with oil and those kind of things, but with the Syrian-Turkish conflict and ISIS, they have moved into a deep alliance together and are cooperating, doing military exercises together, getting closer and closer together as they get closer and closer to the border of Israel. So, are we in the last days? That's a good question. But one thing, here's what I'd want you to walk out of here with today. We have, at the very least, just witnessed a last days partnership between these countries that never existed before until now. And some days when because I know a little bit about the book of Revelation, when I'm sitting here watching television and it's talking about, you know, Israel striking, you know, Iran in Lebanon and Russia coming to help them and that kind of thing. And then the next news story is about the locust plagues in East Africa and you see locusts overwhelming a whole nation. Then you watch the fires burn in Australia and you hear about global warming that now becomes more and more real. And those kind of things, we can say, yeah, it feels a little uncomfortable when it comes to end times, and that's why I put the arrow on end times as up. By the way, Stephen Armstrong, that'd be a great place to go to hear a lot more about that. Let's move to another, a little longer topic, but I want to talk about it because I think it'll encourage you. That's science and Christianity. The arrow for the future on science and Christianity is up. Now that may surprise you because since Darwin in the late 1800s when he proposed evolution as an alternative to creation, science has been at least positioned to relentlessly be an opponent to revelation and Christianity. And Christianity has increasingly been marginalized, especially in the late 1900s and now in the 21st century, to be anti-science. Since the Skunk monkey trials in 1925, believing in Adam and Eve has been reduced to a fairy tale in the general public. Real scientists believe that the universe, at least up until the 60s, was eternal. It was called the steady state theory. And in infinite time with an eternal universe, the evolution of life by random chance seemed absolutely certain and guaranteed. Then came the women's liberation movement in the 60s and 70s, and with it abortion as essential to liberate women from these biblically rigid roles. But, said Christians, that's a baby in a woman's womb. And science said, really? Can you prove that? And so science was called on at that time in the early 70s, and all it could say, lacking ultrasound and 3D scans and fetal monitoring and DNA testing, all science felt comfortable in saying was that emerging life in the womb was, in its words, potential life. And the earlier you went back, just simply a collection of cells. I read that in the Roe versus Wade decision. It's a collection of cells, not a real baby, not at least until some kind of viability as you move into maybe the 6th month. And the Supreme Court at that time, looking for some way to position itself with the general public, seized on that. And in the Roe versus Wade decision made abortion legal, and Christians now, as this scientific struggle goes forward, Christians now were labeled not only anti-science, but with it, coupled with it, anti-women. For fighting against what science could only call a collection of cells, Christians were trying to call it a human life. And so the phrase, my body, my choice, won the day. It won the day. And to date, 60 million potential lives have been aborted with it since 73. Then with that, as we roll just a little forward, came homosexual rights in the 1990s. And though hard science said little on this, the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association, two huge professional, scientific, socially scientific organizations, they both came out in the 80s, late 80s, and reversed their previous position and declared homosexuality, and I'm quoting, as natural and normal. And that's what our kids were hearing over and over again. On top of that, it was assumed, and it was assumed mainly on the testimony of gay people. When they look back in their past, when they were little kids, they would advocate, listen, I was born this way. And then they assumed, and we assume with science, that eventually, just a matter of time, we would find the gay gene, and that would prove that genetic destiny. And so with that, Christianity now became even more than anti-science and even more than anti-women. Now it became hateful, because it was denying homosexuals the sexuality that they were born with and destined for. And as young people have told me over and over, how hateful is that, that you would stand against that? That which they were created to be. So no wonder so many millennials have grown up in this last generation, the 80s and 90s and maybe even early 2000s, and are turning away in large numbers from the church, because they see it as it's been positioned over really the last 50 years as outdated, backward, anti-women, homophobic, hateful, and against real hard science. They just don't want to hear, the public says. Christians are just dinosaurs of a previous era. So I say all that just to lay the context for what I'm going to say now, because there's good news on the front. And that is something I hope you will take with you today. And I wish I had millennials here so they could hear this. But science has changed. right as we moved into the 2000s, it didn't get publicized because the news media is not going to publicize something they don't agree with. But science has been realigning itself even back into the 60s, and nobody really told us this. So that actually it now supports on many issues what the Bible has always proclaimed. So let me just give you a few instances of that. For instance, remember I told you in the 60s, all the way through the 20th century into the 60s, scientists were assuring us that the universe was eternal. They called it the static state theory. It was always the way it was. It will always be. It just kept reproducing itself on infinitum. But then Edwin Hubble, remember Edwin Hubble, Hubble telescope, started looking at the universe, and he made an unbelievable discovery that the universe wasn't always here. It had a starting point that now young people who've never heard anything but this as the Big Bang. That the universe wasn't eternal. It was time bound and it was created. Now scientists didn't link that to Moses. It just became the latest scientific proof of where we got the universe. And so now we just kind of hang out with the Big Bang Theory, but that's what Moses told us 3,500 years ago when he said God created the heavens and the earth, when he said, let there be light, and bang, it was. Now, I'm not saying science and the Bible are perfectly in agreement on all this. I'm just saying, big picture-wise, we are now friends and aligned. Because of new genetic advances, modern medicine, sophisticated ultrasound, 3D imaging, photoscopy, and other kind of things, we're able to do what in the 70s was impossible to do, and that is get up and personal with a fetus in the womb, all the way back to conception, and watch it and study it and take in what really is going on there. I mean, it's unbelievable what a pregnant lady can see with her husband when they go into a doctor's office. It's like they've reached in and they can actually hug their child with the images that are so distinct and graphic. But by going back, especially all the way back to around 6 weeks when human characteristics are becoming quite clear, it is now impossible for the logical mind to look at that and call that a collection of cells when it looks clearly human. It's not potential life. It's human life. And it's clear that it's human life. And with DNA testing going all the way back to conception, we know clearly now that it is a distinct living organism from the mom. It's not the mom. It's separate from the mom. It is already genetically formed with its own destiny of personality and characteristics. It's there from the start, and nowhere can science enter in and say something happened that changed that. All that happened was growth. It just grew. And so now, I just want you guys to hear, some of you may take different positions of this, but here's what I want you to know. If you are pro-choice, you are anti-science. You are anti-science. You are living in a delusion, an ideological delusion that refuses to see what science can see. That's why Bernard Nathanson, who was one of the nation's largest abortion providers in the 70s, when new technology came on board and he could see as a physician, he was doing like 60,000 abortions a month with his clinics. When he saw what he could see with new science, he converted and became pro-life and closed his clinics. So, scientifically speaking, listen everybody, and biblically speaking, the phrase, the thing that you see women carrying, my body, my choice, is scientifically inaccurate. Here's what it should say. Two bodies, my choice. I get to choose what I'm going to do with two bodies, mine and this other human life living within me, and what its destiny is. This is the new scientific reality. And to think otherwise, which our culture does now, it's exactly what other cultures do when they reduce certain types of people to less than human. We just go into an ideology, but it's a scientific delusion. Because of scientific advances unlocking the human genome, we now know, and I want you to listen to this too, might surprise you, no one is born gay. That is, now listen, that's not a biblical, but we've held that biblically. That is now a scientific fact. I want you to listen to Dr. Lisa Diamond, who, she was sharing a talk on the TED Talks, which got passed around in 2018, just a couple years ago, on gay research. She's a professor of gender studies at the University of Utah, but what's more important is she's co-editor of the American Psychological Association Handbook on Sexuality. She's also a lesbian. And she stood before a large crowd and she said these words. I wrote them down. Sexual orientation is not something you are born with. The idea that you are born gay is not scientifically accurate. Now, this is a person at the head of the scientific social community. Let me just say it again. The idea that you are born gay is not scientifically accurate. So what causes homosexuality? I got to interview a gender expert at Wheaton College, and he said what Lisa said, and now what I find others are saying, there's a variety of causes to homosexuality. But the primary bucket that inclines people to a different sexual orientation is the environment that they were in, or grew up in, or now live in. In fact, Lisa Diamond said, environment makes sexuality fluid. Boy, that was an interesting statement. And I thought, I wonder what she means by that. Here's what she said. For some, if they are involved in an environment at a very early age that inclines them to choose this direction, if it occurred early enough, they won't have any other memory before that, and they think they were born that way. But it's an environmental condition that inclined them that way. If in later life, as they move into grade school, the teenage years, college, if the environment is strong enough and it celebrates homosexuality in real positive ways enough, what they are learning more and more is that you're going to have more and more people who consider themselves heterosexual choose homosexuality as a lifestyle. And some will do both. And Lisa said, that's because it's a choice. And you can choose how to express yourself. And then she made this statement, which kind of stunned me. She said, did you know that today there are more bisexuals in America than homosexuals? And that's because of choice. When culture and Hollywood and ads and the environment makes this what the APA call natural and normal, and you see it in all its positive lights, people will reorient themselves in their sexual fluidity. They're fluid, and they will choose. Just like Lisa said, I know plenty of gay people who've chosen to go back to heterosexuality. This is a lesbian speaking. So you just need to know that what the Bible has been saying and what we've been accused of as being hateful, that now all of that's being rearranged to a place that science now agrees with the Bible. Listen, this is an important last line. Science now agrees with the Bible and Christianity that homosexuality is not a predetermined, fixed genetic destiny. It's not. It is the result of a broken world and a personal choice. That's where it is. Now, we have to deal with all that lovingly, compassionately, but also with a certain sense of confidence that what we're calling people to do is not change something they were created to be. That's very important. Then finally, what about evolution? Well, we could talk on this, of course, all day. These are arrows, remember? You need to know that scientists are increasingly today, the latest science is increasingly skeptical about Darwinism and evolution altogether. Listen to Dr. David Gelertner, who's the professor of computer science at Yale. He says this, just flat out, I watched him at a conference say, Darwinism has failed. It cannot explain the random emergence of life, which frankly is mathematically impossible. And then Dr. David Berlinski, leader of the International Review of Science in Paris, France, he says the sheer complexity of life at a cellular level requires impossible time to construct. Random chance cannot produce even one functional protein of life. Not even one. And so I'm sitting there listening to that, and I go, well, then why do we hear so much about evolution from the scientific community? And then Gelertner of Yale said this, at my university, Yale, we've lost free speech on this topic of Darwinism. I say it with real sorrow. Parts of the scientific world are actually bent away from science now on this topic and towards more an ideology. In other words, however impossible Darwinism keeps showing itself to be in a much more modern scientific world, there will be many people who can't let it go who are scientists because they don't want the alternative. Because the alternative, whatever you call it, designer, mind, you know, it's something that can create all this and then let it grow. Okay, big breath. I'm going to move on. Big breath. But I just told you all that to make a simple point, and that is that when it comes to science and Christianity, the arrow points strongly up, and the next generation that's growing up is going to feel more comfortable with that, even as the previous generation of millennials and some of us who've been told otherwise, we're going to feel increasingly uncomfortable because we're going to be forced, like the scientist at Yale, do I keep holding my position by ideology? That's what the future is about in our social world. People living more by ideology, not by science. But Christians can carry science to the next generation because it's firm and clear. It supports the Bible on issues of life, creation, evolution, sexuality, abortion, and homosexuality more than ever before. So all I want you to do today is just be encouraged. The signs of the time are good for us in this field. Then let me briefly mention two more and then I'll be done. Happiness. Let's talk just for a moment. Yeah, I told you this was going to be random, right? I was so pent up I wanted to give 5 messages, but I could only do it this way. It's like the old days. I can just, you know. Okay, for happiness, the arrow is down. Yeah, that's what I said too. Now listen carefully. And I'm just using surveys and statistics and stuff like that. But today in 2020, Americans generally are more unhappy than they have ever been since the founding of our country. I'm working right now with, Bill mentioned Better Man, this new manhood thing. I've been working with the George Barna organization. A lot of you know George Barna is the pollster. We're working together to come out on a where men are in the 21st century research. And Barna's doing it for us. And I've seen a lot of the raw data. We'll publish this and then make it known nationally later on in the year. But in the raw data, one of the stunning things that jumps off the page is how incredibly lonely millennials are. How acutely isolated they are from one another and how they feel like never before that they don't know where to go with all that. They're trying to make sense of all that inside, but they don't know how to connect and have real meaningful relationships. And they are unhappy. Another survey that I've been watching for years is called the General Social Survey. It's a very respected, one of the top surveys on social life in America. It's been going on for 50 years. But here's what I want you to hear. It found, or it has found, that since 1972, that's an interesting year, 1972, but since 1972, women's reported happiness at every level, with every stage, socioeconomically, women's reported happiness has declined. Not just declined one year and then stayed there, it has declined every year since 1972 and did again this year. Women's liberation gave women a lot of things. And quite frankly, some of those things were really good in allowing women to express their gifts and talents and stuff like that more than they could have in a much more, you know, pre-industrial, post-industrial world in this new world of technology. But here's what women's liberation did not give women. It did not give women happiness. And they're telling us. They're stressed. They have doubts and regrets. They're still trying to figure things out and work them through and meeting all the time to talk about it, but they're not happy. And not only that, this is the third year, this is for the general public, this is the third year in America where life expectancy has gone down. Did you know that? We're the only modern Western civilization whose life expectancy has not continued to go up. The last 3 years, life expectancy in America has gone down. Nobody's talking about it. I'm just telling you, that's what's happening. And you ask, what's going on? Something is clearly wrong. I think country Western singer Johnny Lee got it right when he said this: I was looking for love in all the wrong places. You see, social research, now I'm going to go back to science again. Social research, this is what I tell my millennial friends. Social research has documented that people find long-lasting happiness when they're successful in three areas. Close relationships / friends, okay? It actually stands above everything. If you've got good relationships with people, you're going to go the distance in life being pretty happy. Marriage, and lastly, a vibrant faith. There's something bigger than you that you believe in. Those are the three areas that social research tells us that when people have wins in those areas, they're going to feel a sense of contentment and satisfaction about life generally. And yet, science tells us this, but these are the very three things the next generation below us is moving away from. They are lost in their screens and isolated in their relationships in somewhat of a virtual world that they're addicted to in some ways. They're shunning marriage in droves. And there are all kinds, it's amazing, all kinds of Christian couples who don't feel uncomfortable with their son or daughter moving in with somebody before marriage like they're going to test it right. Let me tell you, they found in the social research that not only doesn't work, that inhibits a long relationship. But we believe it because we've been told that. It's going to somehow guarantee success. But they're shunning marriage. And not only that, they're choosing to be nuns rather than really believe. The nuns have belief, but it is the most superficial, squishy, non-rooted belief, and they can change in a moment, and they like it that way. But because of that, they're not pursuing God. They're analyzing religion. So, unfortunately, that's why I have the arrow down. Because if you lose in those three areas in the next generation, you are guaranteeing yourself that you're not going to be happy. You're going to be unhappy. It's going to be a kind of a malaise. And you're going to get angry. And you're going to start demanding your rights. And you're going to say, life's got to be like I want it to be. And I've got to go find a little safe space to live in to reassure myself of that. But it ain't going to work. Okay, last one. My final arrow, hopefully this will be encouraging, is generation Z, Generation Z. And my arrow for that generation is up. Who is Generation Z? That's the young people, 25 and younger, who are now growing up around us, who represent the future. And again, with social research and stuff, just like we did the millennials, the Xers, the boomers, we can test that and you can find out characteristics already about what is going to move them, what they're going to pursue. So I looked up some of the research, and here are some things that mark Zs under 25 that they'll carry into adulthood. These are just some of their characteristics. They're going to be, this next generation is going to be very competitive. They're going to be independent. They're going to be hard workers. They're going to like to work. They're going to be entrepreneurial. They're going to be multitaskers. And I like this one. And they're going to value face-to-face relationships, not distant relationships. That's the generation coming up. And I got to tell you, just reading the characteristics made me a little hopeful, because those traits together mean that this generation has really kind of the characteristics of what you'd call high-level difference makers in the future, if they can hold that, who could shake up things as they are. Because I don't know if you feel this, I can just tell you, we're in a malaise right now as a country. And that happens periodically. But a group that could have these kind of characteristics might raise up and be like some generations before them. In fact, there have been generations before us who've shaken the culture. And interestingly enough, they've done it in mid-century. So for instance, in the mid-1700s, there was a spiritual revolution. In the mid-1800s, there was a spiritual revolution. In the mid-1900s, there was a spiritual revolution. However God designed that generation, if they bought into Jesus, they raised up leaders who became culture shakers. And if you study church history, you get to feel some of that. Bill and I took a group to New England, and we felt some of that with the New England awakenings and those kind of things. Those were real things and real people that we've totally forgot about. But in the 1700s, Jonathan Edwards and his crew and people like him shook up the spiritual life of America. In the 1800s, D.L. Moody came out of Chicago with his crusades and stuff and shook up America and revitalized the church. And closer to home, because you may not be familiar with those names, in the mid-1900s, Billy Graham, Bill Bright, and others came out with where the church was kind of in a pause point, kind of just in a malaise. They shook everything up and launched in the 60s the Jesus movement that for a while shook the culture. But now we've drifted back, I think, unfortunately, to pause. But this generation that's coming up on paper has the right stuff. We just need to pray that God's grace will capture some of them. And by capturing some of them, He will breathe fresh wind and fresh fire into that, and we'll see some new things happen in our culture that will encourage us, especially getting back to what I call basic Christianity. Because I don't think we have another round if they're missing. So I only say this by faith. I'm just saying it by faith and by maybe just a deep hope. I'm praying that arrow is up. Is up. Okay. Five arrows, all pointing to the future. The American family, I hope what it does is not discourage you, but it goes, you know, I need to stand for what the American family really is. The end times, I just say, lift up your eyes and watch what's happening to culture. It's an exciting time, and God's word is amazing in its revelation. And then you think of science. Don't think of science as your enemy. I think what's going to happen is it's going to be more and more our friend. You think of happiness. You need to point people, especially your kids and your grandkids, to the essentials of happiness. Friends, marriage, faith. And then lastly, we can pray for this next generation. Okay, pray with me. Lord, thank you. So grateful just to have an opportunity to download with these friends a thinking on the future. But Lord, we know in the end, our hope is not in information. Our hope is in you. It's just in you. And Lord, regardless of where the future goes, the one thing we know is when it comes to you, the arrow is always up. It's always up. And in good times, bad times, we can trust you with our lives. And we pray that you would use us at whatever capacity we have, in whatever location we are, to remain salt and salty and light and clarity. We just pray that you'd help us be that. And we thank you for that mission until we stand with you in eternity. In Jesus' name, amen.